you hate government, one of them libertarian types, or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all. Scott Horton Show. I'm him. Scott Horton nope, that's not it. ScottHorton.org is my website. Keep all the archives there for you. Sign up for the podcast feed there, too. ScottHorton.org. And follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show. Okay, introducing our good friend Jason Ditz. He is the managing news editor of news.antiwar.com. And every Friday I do Ernie Hancock's show, and every Friday he asks me, so what should people be reading? And I say, news.antiwar.com, man, of course, Jason Ditz, all day, every day, on it. Welcome back. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing good, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing real good. Appreciate you joining us again, and man, do I have a lot of different explosions to ask you about. Jeez, I don't even know where to begin, man. Okay, let's start with the top one at news.antiwar.com right now. U.S. troops increasingly active around Mosul as Iraqi troops push north. And I got to say, I'm getting conflicting signals about just how soon the Iraqi Shia slash Peshmerga slash maybe some Sunni tribes assault on Mosul is to begin. So I guess, yeah, the most important key to understanding the answer would be how many Marines are there and other special forces and spies, and what are their plans? Jason, what do you know?
We really don't know a lot about the numbers of U.S. troops in any given part of Iraq at any given time. As that article noted, the troops that were there supervising the reconstruction of the bridge near Kayara said they'd been moved around a lot, and as soon as the bridge was done, they were going to be deployed someplace else. And the Pentagon doesn't really give us good figures on how many ground troops there are in Iraq, let alone where they are. I mean, officially there are somewhere in the realm of 4,200 troops. In reality, it's more like 6,000. And certainly a substantial number are embedded with the Kurdish forces, so they would probably be largely in the Mosul area. And some are with the Iraqi military around Kayara, but exactly how many, we just don't know.
And then when you talk about the 6,000, that's GIs and special forces, but that doesn't include the Mercs and the CIA, right?
Right. Right. That just includes military personnel, which mm-hmm. includes the officially in Iraq military personnel and then people that are considered to be there on temporary assignment, which they've been using the term temporary assignment to get around a cap on how many troops they're allowed to have in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
But they've also been very, very public when asked about it that they'll have well over 1,000 troops at some times that are considered temporary troops that are there for an indefinite period of time.
I'm trying to remember, Jason, what it was I was reading the other day where they were talking about some of the generals are getting pretty frustrated now. And, you know, I'm trying to remember. I'm sorry, bad context for a question, but they were raising the point that certainly Eric Margolies has raised on this show, which is that, come on, ISIS is the most tissue paper tiger in the whole world. And, you know, as Margolies puts it, the Turkish police could sack Mosul, never even mind the Turkish army. Even the Peshmerga or the Iraqi Shia Special Forces, the Golden Division and whatever, they could go in there and they could take Mosul from the Islamic State. And, I mean, of course, not destroy them, but turn it from a country back into a militia group, back into a terrorist group. And yet, it, you know, here we go on like this. It's 2 years into this thing. And, you know, how many Marines would it even take to sack Mosul? And, you know, to hear Eric Margolies and his take on it, it's all very suspicious to him that, you know, nobody of, and, you know, it's obvious that there are a lot of divided interests between the Shia and the Pesh and the, YPG over on the Syrian side and the Assad government and whatever. But still, nobody's gotten around to sacking Mosul yet. What really is taking so long, do you think?
I think some of it is just how disastrously bad the Iraqi military is organized. A lot of the stories, even when they're trying to take areas around Mosul, villages and the like that are mostly undefended, it's like the Pentagon had a story of when they sacked some villages just south of Mosul, the Iraqi military was moving at just a snail's pace. When they operate around Baghdad, they can move dozens of miles in a day. When they were around Mosul, because it's so far out of their supply lines, they were moving less than a mile a day. Half of their vehicles would run out of gas because they just didn't think, well, we have to refuel our vehicles somehow. They would get flat tires and have no idea what to do and just abandon their vehicles by the side of the road. And at the first sign of trouble, they'd all take off and flee. So I think with the Iraqi military, at least, there's still a sense that there's such a disaster that if they run into any meaningful resistance from ISIS, even if it is token resistance, they're just going to drop their weapons and run and leave ISIS with a whole bunch of new weapons.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny. I guess that really is still, to some degree, a misunderstanding that the Americans are operating under, that there's such a place as Iraq, and that this is the Iraqi army, not the Shiistan army, and that they would have the same kind of motivation to take Mosul that they would have, I mean, hell, even to take Fallujah, which is near Baghdad, and you could see them seeing that really as a threat. But if ISIS is isolated way the hell up there in Mosul, you could see why the Iraqi Shia would have no morale whatsoever when it comes to, come on, let's go die to kick them out of Mosul. You know, that's foreign territory. You know, that's like kicking the Mexicans out of Mexico City. Why bother?
And I think the big driving force for why the Iraqi military is there at all right now is the Peshmerga. Because the Peshmerga are taking territory north of Mosul right now, and they're not just saying, oh, well, we liberated some villages and a couple of towns from ISIS. They're saying, oh, these are now part of the Kurdistan regional government's territory. I mean, they're not just chasing ISIS out there. They're effectively annexing parts of northern Iraq, and in the long run, that's another battle that Iraq is going to be fighting is with the Kurds, and they're getting a pretty substantial amount of territory out of the ISIS war.
Yep. Yeah, and then, you know, eventually at some point, I don't know if this is the next war or this is the one after next, is Iraqi Kurdistan versus Iraqi Shiistan and their fight over Kirkuk.
Right, and That's another thing where, I mean, right at the start of the ISIS war, the Kurds took Kirkuk and said, well, this is part of Kurdistan now. And they're taking all this new territory elsewhere along the frontier with ISIS and saying that's part of Kurdistan now. And I think the real reason the Iraqi military is desperate to get in on the Mosul battle is so it doesn't happen there as well. I mean, I don't know how practical it would be for Kurdistan to annex Mosul, but if they did, it would be an enormous impact on that future war.
Yeah. You know, Danny Davis was in Kurdistan. I talked to him last week, and he said the Peshmerga are telling him that they're worried that the Shiites are going to take Mosul as opposed to just liberating it, that they're going to take it. So I wonder if that's really their worry or – you know, but their plan is to, of course, just let the Sunni Arabs have it, but hopefully not the Islamic State, or whether that's a pretext for the Pesh trying to take it themselves. I mean, on the other hand, you know, the history of the war in 03 was that the Pesh did help drive the Saddam Hussein army out of Mosul, But then the people of Mosul told them, okay, you guys can beat it now, and made it really clear, and they withdrew within like a week. Because they knew that they were not going to be welcome to try to occupy the place. And I think, I'm trying to remember if that, it was, I think it was Patrick Coburn that was explaining how, maybe they were trying to push their luck and see, but, man. And this is no Tikrit or even Fallujah. This is a city of 2 million people. So, I mean, I guess it's possible that they could drive them all out of there and then refuse to let them back, but it would be hard.
Right, and it's probably too big to even attempt that, but and that's not to say they're not going to try. And as we've seen in Syria with the Kurdish forces there, which of course are a different faction, but they've been pretty willing to just when they liberate a city, not let the population back into it.
Yeah. All right. So now let's switch sides and talk about the Western Front of the Islamic State in Eastern Syria, or what used to be, maybe one day will again be Syria. And boy, what a complicated mess over there, Jason. And it's all right. Just take it for granted. Everybody already knows, more or less who's who with the, autonomous Syrian Kurdistan now, versus everybody and America on all sides of this conflict versus, you know, of course, the Shia backed and Alawi Syrian state and its army allied with Hezbollah and Iran and Russia, and then America and, well, Turkey's the wild card. I'll let you fill us in on the variable in this, but America is still, even though they do work with Assad, right, in targeting the Islamic State and bombing people like that. At the same time, they're still backing, the CIA is still backing the Nusra-led jihadist forces against them, too. But now the big rub is, you know, a week ago, the Turks invaded on the pretext of getting rid of the Islamic State. And yet, of course, this was the one we've all been saying was coming, is the Turks finally calling BS on the Kurds over expansionism under the protection of the U.S. and the Russians, the Syrian Kurds there. So now, I guess, I sort of summed it up. What's happened in the last week? How bad is the backlash and the damage coming from the Turks finally crossing the line there?
Well, so far, it's been pretty contained. We've seen a few dozen Kurdish civilians killed in Turkish airstrikes against some villages around Jarabulus, which is the city that they initially invaded. There have been reports of Turkish tanks sort of slowly moving southward and securing all the villages in the area as they move towards Manbij, which, of course, was an ISIS city as well, but the Kurds took it over a couple of weeks ago with heavy backing from the U.S. in a multi-month war that left hundreds of civilians killed in U.S. airstrikes. But now they're being told, well, Turkey's going to take it. The U.S. told the Kurds immediately after Turkey invaded, you guys need to leave Manbij. And now the Kurds are kind of making this weird semantic argument where YPG territory, according to the Syrian Kurdish Autonomous Government of Rojava, is everything east of the Euphrates River. And Manbij is on the western shore of the Euphrates River. So even though YPG forces keep crossing the river and going into Manbij, they're saying there's technically no YPG forces there because under the law, YPG forces can only be east of the river. So once they cross the river, they're not YPG forces anymore.
Okay. And now, when Biden went to Turkey and said, "Hey, you Kurds, you better get in line." I mean, why did he even need to do that? That he couldn't have the special forces inform them that, "Hey, the American, you know, our leader's policy really is you got to stick by this." And then I guess, what's the Kurds' reaction to getting the knife in the back from the Americans on this? Even though they were warned.
So far, the Kurds' reaction has just been to send more and more forces into Manbij and to just sort of dig in with an idea that they're not going anywhere.
And then so, and then the Turks are going to really fight them over it, or what?
It certainly sounds like it. I can't imagine Turkey deciding that having gone to the trouble of invading Syria, Manbij is too much of a hassle to take.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, the Kurds have invested 2.5 months into occupying that city, and they don't want to give it up either. And the United States, I think, is so desperate to keep both as allies that they're just desperately trying to stay out of it and urge both sides to work out a deal where they don't end up fighting. But I don't think that's realistic. I think this is, like you say, this is a battle that's been coming for some time. That Turkey's been complaining about the Syrian Kurds expanding their territory for years now, and they've said the Euphrates River is a red line for them. So as soon as they took cities on the other side of the Euphrates River, Turkey invaded, and now we've got that battle that everyone kind of saw coming.
Yeah. Well, and you know, what the hell was Erdogan thinking in trying to get rid of Assad in the first place? I mean, he has his reasons, but that Trump, the fact that he's actually creating a more or less autonomous or even a sovereign Syrian Kurdistan, he's going to have to go to war with, you know?
Well, ironically, he thought it was going to lead to the exact opposite. With the Arab Spring going on at the time, he had this view that Assad was in a weakened state. These sort of Sunni Arab nationalists would fairly quickly overrun him and take the country. And as a more nationalist faction that's not, that is a majority, a Sunni majority, instead of the fairly small Alawite minority that Assad's a member of, they'd be more willing to crack down on the Kurds when they try to get more autonomy or to expand their influence.
All right, let me change the subject here to, well, there's a couple others. Let's go to Libya here. Pentagon claims only 200 ISIS remain in Libya, and they're trapped. That's one headline, but then the other on the front page was sending more warships to the area, more troops, more weapons to back the new national unity government. Is that it?
Right.
Invasion.
And we just extended our Libya war another 30 days, which those 30-day extensions don't really mean anything because within 24 hours of the first attacks in Libya, officials were publicly admitting there's no timetable for this. We have no idea how long this is going to last. There's no end game in place. But officially it was 30 days and that's gone. So they had to tack on another 30 days and presumably they're going to just keep doing that.
And now the claim here that they're making that there's only 200 ISIS guys left and they're trapped. They have no place to melt away to. And we're just going to, I mean, I kind of like the sound of it in the most cynical kind of way that maybe they can claim victory in a week or two and call it off as opposed to, you know, or another 30 days or two, as opposed to, you know, really making an entire Afghan war out of the damn thing.
Well, it would be nice to think so. In the first place, the 200 ISIS left claim is ridiculous. They U.S. intelligence on the size of ISIS forces has never been very good any place, and least of all in Libya, where the whole country is in a state of chaos more or less all the time. But before this this new war started, we were estimating 8,000 Libyan forces and Libyan ISIS forces, and despite how the U.S. usually claims these inflated death tolls of how many ISIS people they're killing in bombings, they haven't killed nearly 7,800. So where did all these fighters go? And the Unity government's forces, the Petroleum Facilities Guard and the like, early in the fighting after the U.S. started bombing, were reporting, oh, a lot of the ISIS are taking off running. Like, they're fleeing the area around Sirte. So the idea that they're all just kind of pushed up against the ocean in the northern part of Sirte, it doesn't make a lot of sense.
Well, now Haftar, the, I guess we got to assume CIA agent, although, or, you know, asset, although they claim that they don't control him and they're frustrated by him. And he's the guy that more or less controls Benghazi, question mark. Do you know? And then it's the Islamists. It's funny because Benghazi is where the Islamists got our guys and everything. But the Islamist-leaning government actually controls Tripoli. And Haftar, who's the more secular Gaddafi type, is the guy in control of Benghazi in the east now.
Right? Well, he controls part of Benghazi. Uh-huh. He controls a couple of districts. There's some pretty economically important districts, but there is a Islamist Shura Council in Benghazi that is considers itself the city government. There's technically a mayor in Benghazi, which became a story last week because Haftar's forces told the mayor he was out and somebody else was in because the current mayor was related to the Petroleum Facility Guard's head, which is working for the Unity government, and Haftar's forces are working for the Tobruk Parliament, which is one of the rival governments.
Well, I mean, you know, it makes sense if, I don't know, does anybody even talk about, yeah, we should just split the country up and go ahead and, it always was that way. It's not even a World War, post-World War I creation. It's a post-World War II creation, the modern state of Libya. Maybe they should split east, west, and south again like it was back in the day, or at least east and west. That'd be better than having a full-scale war over control of Tripoli, which is something I guess that Haftar's threatened to do but doesn't have the ability to try, thank goodness.
Right, and to some extent, even that, there are some pretty big problems with even trying to make half of Libya a country because, like you say, this is a very modern creation, the state of Libya, and a lot of these cities, you know, there's no national identity in these cities. People identify as the city they're from. They're not a Libyan. They're someone from Benghazi or someone from Misrata, and trying to convince them that they're part of anything bigger than a city or a metro area, they just aren't into that.
Yeah, it's a tribal society, man. That's how it is. Well, you know
right.
What we should do? We should bomb them until they turn into Vermont. Oh, except they're secessionists too, the dang Vermonters. That won't work. We'll bomb them until they turn into Massachusetts. All right, so there's more lies about the Iran nuclear deal that you're debunking. Thank goodness you're on the case full time because Lord knows I ain't going to stop lying about the Iran nuclear deal. And in this case, the talking points, they're pretty thin gruel, but they do have based at the center of them aggressive Iranian motorboat action in the Arabian Gulf. Jason, let us know what's going on.
I mean, first of all, the Arabian Gulf is not a thing. Well, it is a thing, but it's sort of by Egypt, and it's in the Mediterranean Sea. You can find it on a map. It's called the Gulf of Arabs or the Arabian Gulf. In the 1960s, some of the Arab countries in the Persian Gulf area decided, well, we don't so much like Persia anymore. We're going to start calling it the Arabian Gulf. And it didn't really catch on too much outside of Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates and a few other countries. But and the U.S., as they got more and more hostile towards Iran after the Iranian Revolution, didn't really go along with it. But the military did say, well, if you're deployed in these countries or working with these people, just kind of humor them and call it the Arabian Gulf. But we had the commander of CENTCOM, the Central Command, at the Pentagon, giving a statement calling it the Arabian Gulf, these incidents off the coast of Iran. And that's a huge narrative shift, because this has always been the Persian Gulf. This has been the Persian Gulf for 2,000 years.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
Right. And, I mean, really, what's funny is everybody knows the Gulf of Mexico belongs to the USA. It doesn't matter what you call it as far as that goes anyway. And it's international waters, but it's the U.S. that controls ultimate sovereignty over the Gulf of Mexico. It's the same kind of thing here. The only reason to call it the Arabian Gulf is to try to pick a fight when we all know which body of water you're talking about. You know, really just... And I doubt that anyone in Saudi calls it that. It's probably only the American neocon movement that decided, okay, from now on, we're going to call them homicide bombers, guys, or, you know, whatever stupid newspeak talking point they have. From now on, it's the Arabian Gulf. Get it? You know, like, they're so clever and manipulative. They're changing history by changing the name of the thing or whatever. These idiots.
Well, and calling it that. In the Pentagon statement is deliberately trying to be a little deceptive about what really happened. We had these two incidents.
I guess it does make it sound defensive. Like, what are they doing in the Arabian Gulf and all that, you know?
Right. Yeah. And they weren't even really incidents. The first case was they released a video, the Pentagon did, of, we have a destroyer parked off the coast of Iran, and if you look through you couldn't even really see them with a naked eye, but if you look through a zoom lens or a telescope or whatever, you can see some Iranian speedboats kind of come out into sort of the general vicinity. They said they were 300 meters away, and they kind of came out enough to identify the ship and then left. And then the following day, there was a smaller U.S. ship at a different part of the Iranian coast, and the Iranian ships got a little closer because it's a little bit smaller ship, and the U.S. ship fired a couple warning shots, which in both cases, these aren't really international incidents except for the fact that the U.S. decided to make them international incidents and hype them up as this huge problem where, Iran is behaving unprofessionally by trying to see whose warships are parked right off their shore.
Right. Well, you know, I'm sorry, Jason, but I'm about to tell you what Herman Cain said on Twitter. And this is, I mention it because this is, you know, taking the temperature without having to listen to Rush Limbaugh. This is a good way to take the temperature of what, you know, right-wing talk radio echo chamber thinks about this. And that, of course, is those damn dastardly Iranians. This only proves how untrustworthy they are. And these are the people we have our nuclear deal with. And so, of course, they don't talk about what the actual nuclear deal is, other than the thing I read that he linked to said, yeah, we get some... we give them a ton of money and we get some radioactive magic beans and just make light of the thing as though they actually have not scaled back their program, expanded inspections, or any of the things that they've been required to do under the deal whatsoever. They don't even have to address that. But they just say, look, cartoonish supervillainy. You know, look at these guys are threatening our Navy boys and you want to have a nuclear deal with them? So... I mean, really, even though that's kind of stupid, for a couple of different reasons, I think it's worth confronting because you know how it is. I mean, especially on talk radio, that top-of-the-hour news brief
for years straight now never stops mentioning those dastardly Iranians and their latest, you know, nuclear threat, et cetera, like that. So the narrative is very well ingrained in the American right.
Right, and now we have this new report from ISIS, which this is obviously the other ISIS, the David Albright ISIS, declaring that...
Which is worse.
Right, right. They're the less honest of the two ISIS. But,
And they're the one that hates Iran more even than the Islamic State, which thinks that all Shia are heretics that deserve the sword.
They came out with this report yesterday claiming these secret exemptions from the nuclear deal where they're, making a couple of concessions. The P5 plus one are making a couple of concessions to keep Iran technically in compliance with the deal, even though you could jump through a few hoops and argue that it amounts to a violation. And they claim that these benefit Iran, but in practice, the only one of them matters of these two concessions that were emphasized in this report. The first concession, which really doesn't matter, is that when we're counting the amount of 3.5% in low-enriched uranium, which is nowhere near the grade to do anything with except run that one power plant that they have along the coast, is they only count the actual stored low-enriched uranium. They don't count any waste or anything that they have that might have some uranium in it. Which, you know, they were saying, oh, if there's any toxic sludge that has small amounts of 3.5% enriched uranium embedded in it because of the process of enriching it or the process of running that power plant, they're not counting that towards the limit. Which doesn't really matter because none of that could have been used anyway. But the one that actually does have an impact is the heavy water limit. Iran is allowed 100 tons of heavy water. And under the P5 plus one deal, Iran is allowed to make all the heavy water they want. The deal is once they get above 100 tons, they sell it on the international market. And the deal guarantees them access to this international market and guarantees that the P5 plus one nations are going to buy this heavy water. The United States bought the first shipment of heavy water out of Iran after the deal went into effect, and Congress had a fit.
Right.
Even though heavy water is not dangerous, you could drink it and it's not going to hurt you. They bought some heavy water, they sent it around to research labs around the country, and Congress had a fit and said, we're going to put a stop to this.
Yeah, so and behold now, the goalposts here, right? Where we can't have them with have a nuclear material or material that's useful in other nuclear materials or any kind of thing. That's terrible. And then they say, okay, here we have metric tons of it. Let us remove it to your custody. And then, oh, no, you're going to give them money? What a scandal. The Iranians are going to get money for their heavy water. They're going to probably spend that money on terrorism. Well, are we trying to reduce their nuclear capacity or not? Which is the priority here? And what terrorism are they talking about? Backing the Shiite militias in Iraq that are preparing to sack Mosul? To get rid of the Islamic State for us?
Right, that's a big part of it. And realistically, the heavy water concession, the heavy water is not a nuclear weapon threat of any sort. It's not radioactive or dangerous. The whole reason that there was a deal on the heavy water and the P5 plus one agreement is because Iran was in the process of building a nuclear reactor to replace their old medical isotope reactor that used heavy water. And under the deal, they're redesigning it so that it's not going to use the heavy water. But Iran already built this huge heavy water factory to produce it. So they're saying, well, what are we supposed to do with all this heavy water? And the deal was, well, we'll buy it from you so that you didn't totally waste your time building this huge factory.
Right. So then Congress's argument is, well, they should have just poured it down the drain then.
Right. And the concession per ISIS is, well, they got over 100 tons. Nobody wanted to buy it, even though under the P5+1 deal, P5+1 nations are supposed to buy all this excess water. I guess the assumption was going to be that the U.S. would, but Obama apparently didn't want another fight with Congress. So instead, they said, well, just ship it to Oman, and you can store it in Oman, and it won't technically be in Iran, and we won't count it towards the limit. And they're saying, well, this benefits Iran because now they have more than the limit. But realistically, it benefits the P5+1 because they've found a way around buying something that they were, under the deal, supposed to be buying in the first place.
Yeah. All right, now back to the bottom line, just in case anybody kind of got lost on this. In terms of the overall deal and all these little quibble and side issues aside, but the deal was you'll scale back your program in all these different ways, some of which you've referred to here, but in more ways than that. You'll expand your inspections, including to sites where you do not have nuclear material actually being introduced in machines, which is the usual threshold for the IAEA's inspection jurisdiction under a typical IAEA safeguards deal. And so what I'm wondering, what the audience is wondering, because they're certainly told this all the time, I'm wondering whether overall the Iranians are cooperating with the deal and, you know, whatever exceptions, you know, legitimate exceptions you think you could point to, if you have any to point to. But overall, is the attitude that, yeah, them, you know how they are, man, those Persians are always pushing the limit and trying to get away with something all the time? Or is the deal working like the Democrats, those damned Democrats, and I say that like I mean it because I do, said it would?
Well, the funny thing is, I mean, Iran is absolutely complying with the nuclear deal, and most of the arguments around whether the deal is being complied with center around the United States, because a lot of the economic, you know, easing of sanctions, opening up of trade, the United States has not followed through on. In fact, the European Union has repeatedly complained that the U.S. is keeping banking sanctions on them to such an extent that European banks don't want to do business with Iran because they're scared the United States is going to punish them for doing so. And there's sort of a split in the Obama administration about this, where Secretary of State John Kerry is constantly saying, oh no, this is all nonsense. The banking sanctions thing, that's not a real threat. You guys can do all the business you want with Iran. But then the Treasury Department will testify before Congress and say, boy, we're really sticking it to those Iranians. They can't even do business with Europe where we've got such tough sanctions on them.
Right.
Yeah, but I mean, as this far is a as real Iran's concerned, they're absolutely complying.
I mean, this really could lead to the end of the deal, right? I mean, back to the thing with the boats, that's not the president and the so-called moderates, the ones who want warmer relations with the West, who push the deal through. That's their right-wing enemies, the Revolutionary Guard Corps, and those who would, like the American Republicans, like to sabotage the deal. The moderates on both sides are the enemies of the war party, those who would try to get along. But I wonder if you think that, you know, with the combination of the IRGC, you know, sort of, as you said, not really, but sort of given the Navy an excuse, given the right wing an excuse to make hay on this side, and with the Americans being so tough on relaxing all the sanctions, which, you know, the Iranian president had really promised some economic result of this nuclear deal, that we are going to see some real results in our economy improving because of this. And if America is really not letting that result take place, as you're saying, I wonder whether you think a combination of these factors really threaten the deal. I mean, again, as we've been talking about for years, it never was a nuclear weapons program anyway, So even if they left this deal, presumably they would still be under a safeguards agreement, and that wouldn't necessarily mean they're making nukes, but it sure would look like that to all the dum-dums, and certainly that would be what all the propaganda would say.
Right, and this is going to be a major issue. I think the thing that's going to finally be the breaking point one way or another is the question of civilian airliners. Iran's got a very old civilian airliner fleet. They're planes bought from the United States back in the 60s and early 70s. And for the most part, they haven't had access to the right parts to repair them for decades. And a lot of countries won't let Iranian civilian airliners land, not because they don't like Iran, but because these planes are so old, they don't think they're safe. So Iran, with all this frozen assets that are supposedly going to be freed up by the nuclear deal, made huge contracts with both Airbus and Boeing to build them basically a whole new fleet of civilian aircraft, and Congress is threatening to block it. They're saying that this would be a huge threat to national security to sell Iran what are definitely non-military planes, the sort of planes you would see at a civilian airport, 747s and the like. Mm-hmm. But because Boeing's a U.S. company, and because Airbus's airliners almost exclusively have some significant U.S. parts in them, Congress really can block these sales. And if they do that, I think that's going to be a huge incentive for Iran to respond in some way, whether it's withdrawing from the deal or not. They have to do something at that point, because they're simply not getting anything out of this deal in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, their civilian population really suffers just on the airplane parts thing. I mean, Iranian planes fall out of the sky, I don't know to this day or whatever, but certainly in the past, I know at a much higher rate because of these sanctions and because they can't get parts. We've had major crashes of civilian and military planes in Iran, usually unheard of.
It has gotten a little better not even since the deal was passed, but since the deal started being negotiated in earnest.
They got some parts from one of the earlier versions of the deal, right?
Right. While the negotiations were going on, General Electric came forward, and I believe a couple of smaller parts makers came forward and said, you know what, we'll give them the parts at cost. We're not going to make any money on it, so it's not going to be like a something that everyone can get furious at us about, but just for safety's sake, we're going to just give them these parts.
Right. It's funny, you know, the economics of this, where we got to have Boeing on our side. We got Boeing on our side, and even then that might not be good enough to have a major, even military industrial complex firm like Boeing saying, hey, we have a vested interest of, you know, high numbers of deals going on here. And hey, Congress, we sure would like to get our way on this. And even they might not be powerful enough to face down the hawks. And, you know, that's a really sad case. We were joking on the show. I think Mark Perry at the Pentagon reporter was saying, yeah, actually, you know, the good news is some of the weapons firms are getting behind the nuclear deal now because they want to sell weapons to Iran. They want to normalize relations and sell weapons to both sides. And we're joking about how, man, we really got to hope for that. You know, cross your fingers if that's something. So maybe that's the problem here, right, is Boeing. They've got a civilian airliner deal. But if only they could make a deal to sell Iran some F-35s, then you get the Congress on board for peace.
Right, right. And Congress's knee-jerk reaction is always to say no to anything Iran-related. I think Boeing's substantial lobbying power probably will ultimately win out here. It's hard to imagine Congress saying no to a company like Boeing when they want to do something like this.
Right.
like you say, they're huge. They've got all this influence. Some of their top corporate officials have made statements saying, well, if Congress kills this, this is going to be a disaster for Boeing as a company, because Airbus theoretically can find a way around Congress not letting them sell planes. All they have to do is just redesign their planes so they're not using any American parts. And instead of it being half of Iran's huge new contract goes to Boeing and half goes to Airbus, suddenly it all goes to Airbus, and it puts Boeing at a competitive disadvantage.
Yeah, well, it's that whole with Bastiat and the goods crossing borders or armies will and all that kind of thing. You definitely see that. Same kind of thing with China, where, you know, some of these admirals probably would have picked a fight bad enough by now, but somewhere on Wall Street, there's a red phone that says, man, you know, there's just way too much mutual invested, you know, mutual investment between our country and theirs right now that you
well,
just
and
can't
do. Well, and speaking
do
of China, we have the story yesterday of the Army Assistant Chief of Staff, I believe. So somebody in the Army hierarchy that was in Australia on ABC, the Australian broadcast company's radio, telling them, you guys are getting too close with China and you're going to have to make a choice between us or them. That the United States isn't going to put up with Australia being so cozy with China in the South China Sea and in that region.
Well, and what agreements do they even have with China beyond just to trade? They don't have security arrangements and stuff like that with China, do they? Where they join exercises or anything like that?
But they're an enormous trading partner for Australia.
And that's all he meant by that.
Right. And China's the biggest exporter to Australia by a little bit, but by far the biggest importer of Australian products. Because Australia's kind of like Canada economically. A lot of what they produce is raw materials. It's a lot of mining and lumber industry. Mm-hmm. And they've been the go-to place for China to get a lot of their raw materials for their industrialization. So they've become hugely important economic partners for Australia.
Amazing. And, you know, I saw that headline. I hadn't had a chance to read that article yet, but it, you know, I wondered if you know how much impression that made. I'm sure it was the top headline in Australia, but did anybody else notice? Because that to me is, you know, I pretend to be new at this for a minute and think, man, that's pretty outrageous. You know, somebody on the joint staff went and threatened the Australians about their trading partnership. Not that America is an evil empire or anything. No.
Right, and it's some of the more hawkish people in the Australian government, the ones that are more, we need to be really close military partners of America, have been saying similar things for a while. So in a way, his comments are just meant to bolster them. But in practice, so much of Australia's economy is dependent on trade with China at this point. It's unimaginable that if the United States says it's us or them, that they're going to choose the United States. There's just too much at stake.
Yeah. Well, but then again, and I guess we've seen this in the past too, we just had the CIA overthrow their government and change their mind for them. It's happened before, so it's not even just theoretical. Anyway, hey, good talk, man. Thanks for coming back on the show, dude. Appreciate it.
Sure, thank you for having me.
You're awesome. Everybody, that is the great Jason Dance. He is the news editor at antiwar.com, news.antiwar.com, and he's keeping track of all of them, you know, the wars, all 10 of them and more, everything, news.antiwar.com. And that's the Scott Horton Show. Check out the archives at scotthorton.org. Sign up for the podcast feed there and help support at scotthorton.org/donate. Follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. Thanks, y'all. Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink,
so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold the bumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let the bumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's the bumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com.
You drink coffee, I drink coffee, just about everyone drinks coffee. So why bother with anything but the best? Darren's coffee is roasted at his new shop in Claremont, Indiana. And coming soon, you can order on Amazon and support the show by using Scott Horton's affiliate link. Darren'sCoffee.com. Because everyone deserves to drink great coffee.